Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 19th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
That's good. And we're also joined by our other frequent guest, the other prolific commentator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good, good. Glad to have you both here. Well, this show is around is coming up on April 19th. It turns out that that is roughly 6 months, more than 6 months, since Hurricane Maria struck the island of Puerto Rico. Right? It was last August, I guess. So this is March now. It's now 6, 7, 8 months. It turned out in the last couple of days, a land excavator that was trying to remove a tower that was involved in the restoration of electric power to the entire island of Puerto Rico, that land excavator accidentally knocked down a single high-power transmission line and basically put the entire island of 3 million people into 100% blackness, right? The power's out in Puerto Rico here now 8 months after the hurricane. Did I get that story right, DR? Is that the kind of background of it?
Yes, an embarrassment and an atrocity. The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority said it's going to take quite a while to sort of restore electricity to the island, which has already just been, you know, decimated by the lack of electricity and the malignant neglect, if you will, of the Trump administration. Just a grotesque shame and one of the, what has to be considered one of the worst cases of environmental injustice of all time.
Go ahead, Mara.
It says there's that before the blackout, there was still 40,000 people who had not regained normal electricity service.
Since
so
last
even
August.
Before. Yeah. Yeah. So as you know, what did we say? 7 months, 40,000 people who still don't have power. That's bananas. I mean, that's just crazy.
And this, by the way, is not in a third world country. This is in the United States of America, which is, I guess for my estimation of this is that it's kind of a moment, it's a kind of a microcosm, right? There's something going on here that's bigger than the exact story about an island in the Caribbean. There is a there's meaning here about that needs to be discussed. I mean, aside from the obvious immediate and horrible injustice of what's happening to American citizens on the island of Puerto Rico, it seems to me, DR, you touched on it, there's environmental justice issues. It seems to me that this is a kind of a taste of the future, right? We often talk about how climate change will impact the least powerful first. And here, right in the United States, we have this sort of egregious example of, I mean, no electric power for now the whole island is out, but there are people here that have been going on a year without power, and the hurricane season is going to be here in a month or six weeks or so, right?
And can you imagine what sort of devastating hurricanes will hit Puerto Rico this year? And I mean, could we? I mean, not to sound too far fetched or sound too dystopian, could we see a scenario in which the power failures are so chronic that you essentially see a mass evacuation from the island of Puerto Rico, where the island is essentially left barren because people basically say, you know, we cannot live like this. We have to simply, you know, abandon the island. And whatever resources there are on the island, will they just be, you know, strip mined by whichever contractor comes in and says, hey, there are no citizens here. Let's have at it, Hoss.
I don't know, Mariah, if you've heard anything, but I've sort of seen discussions of the diaspora of Puerto Ricans back into the United States, right? People
if they
just
have
can't
money.
Handle it. If they have money, they can come here. And if they can't, then they're stuck in the dark.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's the whole environmental injustice. If you can get out, a lot of people have, right? They have a second house in the mainland or something, or they have close friends or family on the mainland. And I mean, you know, so I guess that the big part of the problem is that the infrastructure for for power on Puerto Rico is incredibly outdated and old. It's an old above-ground power grid that's way behind any of the infrastructure on mainland America that has, you know, gets frequent improvement. I don't know, frequent improvements, but gets improved. And that's been a big part of the problem for Puerto Rico as well. They're just, they haven't been receiving the much needed improvements that are required to withstand these kinds of storms.
And the thing that I saw said that lack of infrastructure improvement is tied to the basically the debt that the island is carrying, which is kind of a political choice in some sense that the United States has imposed on the island, the territory of Puerto Rico, but that they have this massive debt and then they can't build the infrastructure. I guess the point I was going to make with regard to that, the infrastructure falling apart, is that we spent time talking about Puerto Rico as an example of an island that could be rebuilt with renewable power. And the thing I saw, DR, I think you sent it through from WBUR, saying that the Corps of Engineers is now faced with the task of making the new high-voltage transmission lines across mountain ranges, right, and how difficult that is and how it slows everything down. But it screams for an application of distributed generation, of having solar panels on both sides of the mountain so you don't have to build a power line over it. And again, this is an example of where renewable energy solutions that are distributed and closer to the users are an advantage, are the right way to go. I mean, have you seen anything about the possibility of that, or where we are with
what happened with Musk? And you know, he was going to do a bunch with the solar power.
Right, and I think it takes money. I mean, Elon Musk is busy shooting his Tesla off to Mars someplace, which is great, but it costs a lot of money to rebuild an island, and I mean that money has to come from the government, right?
And
do you think
do
that's
wonder.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you do wonder, you know, for people like Musk and for others who want to put some, you know, clean energy on the island, you do wonder what bureaucratic hurdles will be thrown in their way by the current administration to prevent them from doing so, prevent them from providing as much clean energy as is needed by people who, again, is it too morbid to think, is there some sort of I know it sounds, and call me crazy, but you do wonder, is this not on some level a deliberate effort to sort of clear the island out?
Yeah. I mean, what was the movie with the people, the blue people?
Avatar?
Avatar, right. I mean, this sort of paradise taken over by a corporation. Right? I mean, there's, to say that there's ethnic cleansing, right, is over the top, but I don't think that Trump and his people care that much if the island gets depopulated because there's no power. I mean, it's just like beneath their level of concern.
Well, some of the problem, of course, is that they don't have any political power, right? They don't have any representatives. They don't have, you know, they're not a constituency that can put pressure on anyone to speak up in their behalf. And, you know, you think, well, isn't the current administration at all concerned with their reputation, you know, of how this is going to affect all of these people that have been struggling there for so long? Shouldn't that have some sort of pressure? And maybe we need to be making more noise about it. I mean, we've been making a lot of noise on the Climate Minute podcast, but, you know, maybe it really requires a whole lot of people. I don't know, another march for Puerto Rico.
Well, I think
we've had a lot of marches lately, but
it does speak to the whole question of, you know, who are your allies? Who are you working with? And what? Because you're right. If the voiceless need a voice, right? Who's going to speak in a political sense, for the people of Puerto Rico who can't vote in Congress? Who's going to apply pressure in Congress? I mean, I think it has to be, you know, other Americans who. I mean, Mariah, a couple of weeks ago, you made this very interesting list of things that climate hawks should be standing for, and I think one of them you said was democratic integrity, which is a word that stuck with me. You may not even remember having said that, but you got to be careful what you say because people listen.
I did.
But I mean, the whole idea that we would let sort of the fabric of the country and fellow citizens live in no power you know, with no electric power, when that could be rectified, and they are also American citizens, that strikes at the integrity of our institutions and how we are as a country. So, I mean, this goes beyond, so, I mean, environmental injustice does the same thing, but I mean, climate hawks being in favor of democratic integrity is a founding kind of principle that you can hang your hat on, that we have to have this this baseline of decency, and it shows up in Puerto Rico. I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And especially when there are so many obvious solutions and advantageous ways we could go about rebuilding the place.
Right. And it, I mean, I agree with you. It definitely seems like solar, with a complicated geography and terrain, solar or something that's a little bit more, you know, focused to certain areas is way better than power lines trying to be stretched all over. I mean, some of the problems is that old power lines have been grown over, right? They had some that have fallen and they were never restored in time. And now they're completely grown over with vegetation because right. It's been so long.
Right, right, right.
So it's the perfect time to rebuild in a way that makes more sense for the 21st century.
So I will make it a point of calling my congressmen and my senators and saying something about Puerto Rico. Because if no one says anything, then nothing will get said, and it'll just drift along. So
I urge you, if you have,
it's easy enough to do, and of course, it's good practice. If you feel morally compelled to make that phone call, all of a sudden you've done it. You've called your senator's office. You find out the sun came up the next day. You weren't mortally embarrassed, right? All those, I mean, it's a good feeling. It's a nice habit to get into, to express yourself to these guys. So I would call your senator and your House of Representatives, your congressperson, tell them that you care about this issue and that it's an injustice. Well, okay. Let me put down my white-hot outrage there for a minute. And there's a different topic that is somewhat somber, but it's one that requires comment, or at least requires recognition.
White-hot outrage was maybe a little too apropos. It is somber, but
who wants to tell the story of what happened this past weekend with the environmental activists down in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I can jump in, and I'm sure DR can fill in some holes. But so David Buckle, who was a advocate for LGBT rights. He was a lawyer that did a lot of work for LGBT rights, clearly someone involved in human rights in general, but also very strong advocate for climate change. And he I think he also worked at a composting facility. He was running this really successful composting facility. And on Saturday, he basically lit himself on fire. He said, you know, most humans breathe air made, he sent an email to the New York Times saying most humans breathe air made unhealthy by fossil fuels and many die early deaths as a result. And he said, my early death by fossil fuels reflects what we're doing to ourselves. So this was his sort of, you know, protest. I think he did it in sort of the honor of the Buddhist monks who set themselves on fire and sort of a political protest of sorts. It's really sad. I think 6:30 a.m. someone found him in Prospect Park in Brooklyn.
That's quite a story. I mean,
let me
ask you, DR, first of all, just aside from the sort of human sadness and somberness that kind of story brings on, what do we think of the symbolism? Right? How do you think that is a symbol that is useful? I mean, I suppose at a level of pure utilitarianism, as if he did such a thing to make a statement, is that a statement that can be leveraged?
Oh, I have to admit, it's really had a profound impact on me when I read the story, and I think that we'll never know how many people he may have reached by virtue of this action. I think it is an indictment of the profound lack of action in the United States. He was said to have been horrified and disgusted, and absolutely so and justifiably so, by the savagery of Scott Pruitt and Donald Trump. And I'm sure he was horrified by what's going on in Puerto Rico and what have you. And just to think about, you know, just the level of inaction that motivated him to take this action, to try to galvanize people, just in the way that others who have used self-immolation as a form of protest have done previously, to try to galvanize people to put this issue at the tip top, at the main event of their political and cultural concerns. It was a primal scream, I think, to try to wake people up. I think there's been the speculation that he, you know, and speculation that I have to say that I disagree with, absent any evidence of this sort of speculation that he was somehow mentally ill or disturbed, or if there's no evidence of that, and his family, you know, there was a story in the New York Daily News basically, you know, his family was saying that, you know, he was perfectly healthy and he went out on his terms. I think that he basically felt that, you know, when you think about it, again, we've talked about this before, if this is the 30th anniversary a Jim Hansen going to Congress and saying we have to do something. It's been 30 years and absolutely nothing's been done. And this guy figured, what the hell is it going to take? Mm-hmm. What is it going to take to wake people up and to put this right at the main event above anything like, you know, we think of all the issues that are in the main event of political concerns, terrorism, the economy, what have you. This should be right there at the tip top, and we will never know how many people saw that story, and just like from people who saw the stories of self-immolation for other issues, and they were roused to action, how many people this man will have roused to action by virtue of what he did? Even if someone disagrees with the manner in which he chose to make this statement, it's a statement that no one's ever going to forget, I don't think.
I mean, I will give that point its due, because you know, I remember I'm a kid, I'm in high school, it's the 60s, we got Newsweek magazine. So everything I knew about the world, I read Newsweek magazine every week. And Newsweek started publishing color photographs, right? So this was, God knows when, 66, 67, and a full-page color photograph of a monk in Vietnam in the saffron robe, sitting, cross-legged, a flame, right, that he doused himself in gasoline, lit himself. I'm still carrying that image in my head all these years later, right? And so these things do have power, whether or not, sort of absent that kind of graphic imagery, but I agree with you, it's certainly a strong statement.
You know, I just wonder, I mean, here's a man who seems eloquent, brave, passionate, clearly involved, and you know, the only thing that strikes me is, but what more could he have done in his life in positive ways? I mean, certainly he has called attention to it, and it's terrible that this is the kind of thing that it has to come to for us to pay attention to climate change issues. Is this really how we need to get attention? I mean, that's awful. Our country certainly needs to wake up, but I also lament the loss of someone who clearly was an effective voice in other ways. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to me that he was so distressed that he just didn't see a good future for this earth unless he did something like this.
But I do have to say, you know, one of the things that he was famous for, that he represented the family of Brandon Tina, who if people remember, 25 years ago, Brandon Tina was the transgender Nebraska, I believe, resident who was horrifically, one of the worst hate crimes in modern U.S. history, which inspired the movie Boys Don't Cry with Hilary Swank. And, you know, if you think about the parallels, I mean, maybe this is a bit morbid, maybe this is a bit odd to say, but as horrible as what happened to Brandon Tina was, I think that woke up a lot of people who I know friends of mine who had some very, very retrograde views about the LGBT movement. But when that incident happened, even before the movie came out, when that incident happened, they were like, oh my, you know, we really need to reconsider. And right here, this individual, you know, we'll never know how many people will be reconsidering their own views on this. And even if they accept the science, you know, reconsidering their sort of, you know, come see, come saw views of the issue.
What I was going to say was that the sort of passive acceptance of what is, I mean, we've talked on this show at some point about, you know, are we kidding ourselves, right? If you really, really took seriously what the things you're told, you know, the game's up, right? What are we doing here, right? And so his reaction is maybe one that is not crazy, right? I mean, he says, here's where we are, right? And we're the ones that are sort of ignoring reality.
I guess he did a lot of work with people sort of who are toward the end of their lives. And one of the things that he was really passionate about was the right to choose the time and manner of your death. And he really wanted to control the end of his life. So to your point, Ted, maybe there was this part of him that was like, look, I don't want to die in a hurricane, climate change-induced hurricane, or, you know, whatever catastrophe Mother Nature is bringing toward us. So I'm going to make my statement and choose when I go.
Well, I think it's certainly something that causes discussion in dear listener, if you haven't had a chance, didn't catch that piece of news, certainly something that brings up a lot of different questions, right?
We need a movie about it.
I think in the last, and so anyway, our best wishes to all of the people around Mr. Buckle who are now dealing with that fact. I think in the last couple of minutes of the show, we wanted to talk about something that's a little bit more upbeat. I will set the stage, DR. You can come in and tell what the story is. But as you may remember, the hated Exxon company hid the fact that they knew about climate change, the reality of climate change, for decades. Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts has sued Exxon for damages, basically, without going into detail. They've sued Exxon for fraud related to the fact that Exxon knew these things. Part of the issue was to try and, what the Attorney General wants to do is get the documentation out of Exxon. Exxon, in response, sued the Attorney General, a countersuit, and wanted to basically get all the documentation from the Attorney General proving that, to try to prove that she was biased in her lawsuit. About a week and a half ago, a federal judge told Exxon to go pound sand, that they could not investigate the Attorney General. That would just not, wasn't going to happen. The Attorney General could proceed. There was another court case before the SJC, or the Supreme Judicial Court here in Massachusetts, again between ExxonMobil and Attorney General Healey. And so tell me, DR, what was the latest turn of the screw in the Exxon new, hashtag Exxon new story?
Yes, in a 6-0 unanimous ruling, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court basically said that Exxon has to hand over, you know, the 40 years worth of documentation that Maura Healey has requested as part of her civil investigative demand. And they have to basically, I believe there was one report saying that they have to sort of, as part of the records they have to turn over, Exxon has to give to Maura Healey records of their work with entities such as the American Legislative Exchange Council and the Heartland Institute and other climate denial organizations. So it's unclear what Exxon plans to do next. And I don't, because I think this is, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but because this involves a state matter, I'm not clear as to whether or not they can try to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So they may be stuck in a situation where they do, in fact, have to turn over the material. And it's going to be a lovely, lovely thing to see all that stuff in the book. Who knows? They were probably working with Michael Cohen, too. How do we know?
You beat me to that one, DR. Yes. Well, and so the good news is that Maura Healey, the white, I don't know, what's a female knight, Mariah? What's the female equivalent of a knight? The white knight from the Attorney General's office. Maura Healey is doing the right thing, winning the battles against the Dragon of Exxon. God bless her.
I call her Mighty Maura.
Mighty Maura. There you go. All right. There's the, maybe that's a show title. Okay, we have to, we need to put it down there. Let me, sorry, we've actually gone on a few minutes longer than we anticipated, dear listener. You can check out the links to most of what we talked about at our blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on almost any of your favorite podcast distribution apps. So go get them. We'll close where we always close by We'll close where we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration, i.e. in Puerto Rico, not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here, Mariah.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.